Welcome to the Alabama Literacy Network's podcast, which is designed to share information and best practices for literacy. We hope to bring a wide variety of resources together to help school leaders, teachers, and parents so that all children read at high levels. We believe that literacy is a fundamental right that is tied to so many positive outcomes that we want for all citizens. This podcast was brought to you by the Literacy Reimagined Conference coming to Mobile, Alabama, March 6th through 8th, 2024. This is an excellent opportunity to learn more about the science of reading and its application to practice, as well as connect with a community of learners from across the state. There is a fabulous lineup of speakers, including Dr. Kimiana Burke, Dr. Antonio Fierro, Dr. Tracy Whedon, Dr. Pam Kastner, Dr. Matt Burns, Dr. Ann Whitney, Melody Ilk, Carrie Curto, Dr. Laurie Lee, Dr. Kevin Smith, Dr. Michelle Elia, Michael Hunter, and Dr. Linda Farrell, and the list goes on. Register today to make sure that you are able to attend this incredible event. I'm your host, Shelley Bell Smith. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Sharon Vaughn. Dr. Vaughn is Manuel J. Justice Endowed Chair in Education, Executive Director of the Meadows Center for Preventing Educational Risk at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Vaughn was the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Learning Disabilities and the co-editor of Learning Disabilities Research and Practice. She is the recipient of the AERA SIG Distinguished Researcher Award and the University of Texas Distinguished Faculty Award. She is the author of numerous books and research articles that address the reading and social outcomes of students with learning difficulties. She is currently the principal investigator or co-principal investigator on several Institute for Education Sciences, National Institute for Child Health and Human Development, and U.S. Department of Education research grants investigating effective interventions for students with reading difficulties and students who are English language learners. She is the author of more than 35 books, 250 peer-reviewed research articles, and 65 chapters that address issues related to research and practice with learning problems. She has worked nationally and internationally with educators from Japan, Canada, Sweden, Norway, Portugal, Australia, and Singapore. Welcome, Dr. Vaughn. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to talk to you, Shelley, and thank you so much for the information about the Reading League. I'm a member of the Reading League. I want everybody listening to be a member of the Reading League. They put out fabulous information, and they can really help all of us do our jobs better.
Absolutely. Our Reading League in Alabama is brand new.
Good for you.
I'm the secretary. And so we're just really excited and wanting to get the word out to everyone. What can you tell us about how you got started in working with literacy?
Well, I think the way I would mention it is that I think that literacy is really like the green card that gives us opportunities. So when I was in education, I'm a first generation college graduate. So my parents did not graduate from college. And so I really felt like I had an obligation as an educator to make sure everyone had opportunities. And, you know, I really don't think, Shelley, there's a better way to open doors for children than through literacy. And here's what I mean. It's not just reading. It's really access to knowledge and access to a future. And so, you know, I don't think we can exaggerate the importance of learning to read, nor can we exaggerate the challenges that people have to overcome when they are not proficient readers. So I think really I wanted to be a difference maker, and that seemed like the right way to do it.
I love that. And I was jotting notes as you talk, and I think that access to knowledge and access to a future is just sums it up.
Yeah.
And that's really what drives so much of what all of us who are advocating and working for change in literacy are doing it for.
And, you know, Shelley, it's also one of the reasons why when I hear teachers saying, well, you know, he's in second grade, he didn't learn to read this year, but he'll learn to read next year. And when people say, well, you know, he's young or she's young and, you know, they'll learn to read when they get older. One of the reasons I sort of cringe when I hear that is because it postpones this access. Because actually learning to read makes you smart. It teaches you words. It gives you background knowledge. And so really, we're denying not just literacy, we're denying information. And so I get frustrated when people don't sort of get enthusiastic about having students learn to read early and often.
Absolutely. So you're the executive director for the Meadows Center for Preventing Educational Risk. Like, I can't imagine that they could find anyone better than you to run that, because just listening to all that you've done, it seems like your life has been dedicated to this very mission. What can you tell us about the center?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you, Shelley. And I'll be sure to tell everybody what you said, that they just can't find anybody better. And Shelley Vale Smith says that. And so therefore, you should just take that and run with it. But what I can tell you about the organization is, first, let me just sort of direct people to the website. So if you go to Meadows Center, just like a meadow, M-E-A-D-O-W with an S, meadowcenter.com, what you're going to see is that all of our materials and resources, all of our lessons, all of our tips and guide books are all available free. Everything is downloadable. It's available free. We have all just a huge library of lessons from kindergarten all the way through high school. And these lessons are very explicit and they're available to you. Lots of guidance about students with reading difficulties, teaching word reading, teaching vocabulary. We've got a lot of comprehension exercises there. So just go take a look, walk around in the meadow, if you will, the www.meadowscenter.org, and see if any of the materials or resources are useful to you.
I love that. And that's when fairly recently, I was working with one of my former students as a guest on the podcast, Harper Howard, and she's been really advocating for mental health. And she suffers from anxiety. And then I was a small part of her being diagnosed with dyslexia. Obviously, she had been suffering from the effects of the dyslexia and the anxiety for a long time. And I think people sometimes don't really connect anxiety with dyslexia and other reading difficulties. Part of this is what you worked on at Meadows and in other places. What has your work shown on the connection between dyslexia and other reading difficulties and anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, Shelley, that's a really good question, because I think a lot of us think of academic issues and social emotional issues as being separate. We sort of think of them as two sort of parallel highways, if you will. But really, the connectivity between the two is quite strong. So, I mean, it's not hard to imagine that someone who has a lot of difficulty learning to read would be uncomfortable and, as we would say, anxious if they were asked to read, especially if they were asked to read in front of others, even if it's a small group, another student, two students, three students, much less a larger group. It's embarrassing. And especially if a student already has some anxiety about school when they come in. So what we've kind of learned is that there is a reading anxiety, meaning that even if you are not anxious generally, so maybe you are not an anxious person overall, you can have reading anxiety if you have reading difficulties, in which what makes you anxious is the thought of reading. So kind of think about it this way. If you start thinking about reading as being something that makes you anxious, when you get anxious, you get this sort of cognitive flooding, meaning that your mind starts being concerned and starts getting occupied. And it makes it difficult for you to concentrate on the task at hand, so that you get this sort of, if you will, negative cycle going, where you are supposed to be reading, or you know that it's time to practice reading. You get anxious because that makes you uncomfortable. Then you start flooding with emotions and feelings about that, which interfere with your reading. So now it is more difficult for you to learn to read. And you can sort of see how this cycle could be challenging. And so what we have put some work into, my colleague Amy Grills and Phil Capen and I, have put some effort into thinking about how to integrate anxiety management within reading interventions. So if you teach children to monitor and recognize this anxiety, and in much the way we as adults do that, and we think about how to calm ourselves, and we learn strategies and practices to reduce our anxiety, we are going to be more successful at the tasks in hand. And so we don't just teach students these anxiety management practices. We do that. But you know what else we do, Shelley, that I think is really kind of cool? Is that while we're teaching these reading practices, we use reading materials in vignettes about similar children who have anxiety. And we read that as part of our reading instruction, but we also use that to apply some of the anxiety management practices. So for example, what would you tell this student to do in order to reduce their anxiety? So we try to blend it. It's not just a layered, it's an integration of anxiety management and reading intervention. I hope that made some sense.
Oh, it's brilliant. And I'm just thinking, parents often contact me and they're really seeking help for their children whose anxiety is so severe that they don't want to go to school at all. And then just really thinking about that reading anxiety and how it impacts the entire function of reading. And so just integrating the management and the improving the reading skills is so smart.
We're working on this. We had a grant from the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. So we had 5 years for some development and efficacy studies. And now we're seeking funding from the Institute for Education Sciences. So we really want to continue this work. We think it's very promising. And we also think it's really necessary. I mean, you probably know, Shelley, you see this probably in your own work. Don't you think students are more anxious now than they've ever been before?
Absolutely. I think adults are more anxious than they have ever been before. I think our society has more mental health issues that we're dealing with, and the anxiety is rampant.
Yeah, I do too. And I think that we can learn practices. There's no sort of golden answer that will solve everything, but we can learn practices that will help us with our anxiety management. And we can teach children these practices. And I think that's very promising.
I do too. And as someone who has anxiety myself.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Well,
how do you do a podcast with anxiety? Now, that's really a good one.
I've had to teach myself, you know, how do you manage that so that you can still function? I know that some of your work focuses on improving reading comprehension for students, which is a really hot topic for many reasons. There's a lot of talk about it, but I sometimes think that we go about it in the wrong way. What has your research found should be happening for improving reading comprehension?
You know, I'm really glad, Shelley, that you brought up this topic of reading comprehension, because I want to use it as an opportunity to provide a clarification for your listeners. You know, the Reading League has been such a great source of knowledge about the science of reading, and they have really helped explain and also recognize misunderstandings about the science of reading. And I think one of the common misunderstandings about the science of reading is that it's all about phonics, or it's all about the foundation skills. And I think I want to clarify for your listeners, if there's any of you out there that think that's true, I want to say it's not. The science of reading is about reading to learn, reading to understand. Now, we know these foundation skills like phonics and phonemic awareness contribute to that, and we want to emphasize them. But the science of reading really is about getting students to understand what they read. You have to be able to read the words correctly, and you have to know what they mean, and you have to have background knowledge. And if you have those three things, you're really going a long way towards reading for understanding. So I think that as you invite me to talk a little bit about improving reading comprehension, I'd say, don't forget, you can't comprehend if you can't read the words. So I always start with the words. Everything starts there. We've got to be able to read them. But also, if you can read them, like I can in certain foreign languages, but I don't know what the words mean. I don't have the vocabulary. Well, that's not going to do me much good for reading comprehension. So I have to be able to read the words and I have to know what they mean. But then I also have to have adequate background knowledge. So for example, if I were reading a book in English about a black hole or some abstract physics concept, I would have the ability to read the words. I might even know what most of the words meant, but my background knowledge would be inadequate. So my reading comprehension would be, so we need to kind of think about the three prongs that really help lift reading comprehension. And so as teachers, if we sort of keep all three of those in mind, we'll go a long way. But of course, there's also other things to think about. So a big push to improve reading comprehension is inference making. So we have to be able to kind of understand and make inferences about what the author means. So what is the author's intent? What is the author saying? And what are the implications of that? Because if we can't make those kinds of inferences, then reading comprehension is going to be elusive. Also, when we're focusing on what we think of as like information text, like we're reading history or science, we also have to be able to use some of the figures and tables and pictures and graphs. And we also have to be able to go back and search for information that will help us understand what we're reading. So there are mechanisms, processes, and strategies that we can put into place that are more likely to help students read for comprehension. But I do want to say that the three prongs that I mentioned earlier, being able to read the words, knowing what the words mean, and having world knowledge or background knowledge, is really going to take us a long way. So if teachers just kind of keep those three things in mind as they focus on a variety of texts at a variety of levels, they will help students accelerate the speed at which they're reading and understanding, and reading comprehension will improve.
And that's a really great visual in my head, are those three prongs and how all three of those are needed for it to work right.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So you work with countries around the world on reading intervention. What do you think we're doing well in this country and what could we improve upon?
I really like that question, Shelley, because I think it's important to ask, what are we doing well? And I think one of the things we have always emphasized, many people might argue with this, but I think they're wrong. I think we have always pushed in hard on reading comprehension. And in fact, sometimes we focus on reading comprehension and we forget that it's a result of word reading and word meaning, and we haven't focused enough on the word reading and the word meaning. But I think we've done a good job developing reading comprehension strategies, reading comprehension practices, inference making practices, and we've done some pretty good studies on reading comprehension. I think the United States really sort of leads right now the English-speaking world in the quality and amount of research on reading that we do. So there's good research coming out of many countries. I don't want to underemphasize that. But I think we have had a prominent role in both the conduct and interpretation of research. So I think we're doing that well.
Anything that we could improve upon that comes to mind?
Well, that's a long list. Well, yeah. I like the fact that you asked what we're doing well, so we could start with that. Here's a few things. I won't say everything, but here's a few things I think we could think about. The first thing I think we could think about is that being a successful reader and comprehender involves deliberate practice. Those two words, deliberate practice. And what that means is we are not going to get better at reading by listening to someone talk to us about reading. We are not going to get better at reading by having someone stand in front of us and point to words and we read one or two words a day. We are only going to get better at reading if we have deliberate practice reading. And of course, we need instruction, we need feedback, and we need support. But I got to tell you, one of the things that worries me, Shelley, is that what we could inadvertently do is focus so much on the reading instruction, which is teachers talking about reading, and inadequately focus on the deliberate practice with support of actually reading. Can you imagine wanting to get better at anything and not having to practice a lot? I mean, you are not going to get to be a better cook, Shelley, if someone talks to you about cooking. You're going to have to get in that kitchen and get going. Now, you need guidance, you need feedback, and you need support. But I just worry that we might be underemphasizing that.
And I love just thinking about that volume of practice, that just sheer reading work. And so I think that that's really relevant. And even when we look at perhaps our small group instruction, how much time are we actually having students read or and apply what we are doing instead of these isolated skills? So I think, you know, that is right on target.
I just want to say, I think you just said a summary statement that is right on target. We have to really watch in our small group instruction how much time students are reading. And it better be at least half the time. The other thing I worry a little bit about is that we might be restricting the range of levels of books that students read. Students need to read a wide range of books. They need to read books at various levels. They need to read decodable books. Of course they do. They need to read books that have words that they've learned and practiced. Of course they do. But they also need to read other kinds of texts that allow them to acquire more access to words, and including vocabulary words, and to build background knowledge. And the harder these texts are, meaning the more difficult and challenging they are for the student, the more support they need from the teacher. However, we do not want to deny access to these challenging texts and these texts that cross levels.
Amen. As someone who loved to read all kinds of things as a young reader, I really believe that that's part of what developed me into a proficient reader, was the wide reading and just not being restricted on anything that I read. So I appreciate you saying that. One of the things that you've worked on that I absolutely love and I show people all the time when I'm working in schools is the What Works Clearinghouse Practice Guide on Reading Interventions for Grades 4-9. And you chaired the panel that put all of that together. For people who don't know what a practice guide is, can you tell us about why they're important and maybe some things about this particular guide?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, if you are not aware of the What Works Clearinghouse Practice Guides, if you go to the IES, three letters, and you go to their website, and in their search, if you put in practice guides, a number of practice guides will pop up on topics that relate to beginning reading, that relate to progress monitoring, that relate to mathematics instruction. And the one you're focusing on is a practice guide on reading interventions for grades 4-9. So that one will pop up too. And it's the newest one that they've issued. And I think one of the things you'll like about this is this practice guide is broken into several components. So the first thing you'll see are the recommendations, and they will list very specifically instructional recommendations. And the nice thing about these practice guides is you can have confidence in them because they are based on the best scientific research we have. So if you look at the recommendations, and you want to know more, for example, how do I teach multi-syllable reading instruction, one of the recommendations from that panel, you can then go to the practice lessons they provide. And they give really good examples of what you should do and what you should not do. And they give sample lessons to go with it. I, like you, find these practice guides sensational. And I think teachers that aren't using them are really missing an opportunity to not just learn, but to kind of make their instruction more impactful.
Absolutely. And a large part of my job is helping schools write their improvement plans. And I literally use these practice guides to say, this is what the research says is going to help move whatever metric that you're working on. And so I just think, number one, it's great research, and it's really well put together and anyone could use it. And then, like you say, the practice lessons and the resources that come with it are just phenomenal. I had such a good time just looking through the resources, thinking, oh, I would do this and I would do that. So
I completely agree. I think the sample lessons that are in the practice guides and in the practice guide that I worked on as the panel leader, I have to tell you, Joe Dimino is one of the individuals on the panel that put together a lot of those lessons. And he just did a spectacular job and very clear and very easy to follow. And you know what? I think you teachers are going to enjoy doing it. It's really engaging work.
Yeah, and impactful. And so when we start seeing students move and be successful, that is that motivation for us and for them.
Yeah.
So I've read the practice guide numerous times, and it was really affirming. Like some of the things that I would have said were important were in there. Mm-hmm. I wonder what you think about this kind of knowing-doing gap that we often encounter. Like there's a lot of research out there. It's accessible. And then we don't necessarily see people actually doing what's recommended.
Yeah, I think that it might be one of the most heartbreaking things about our job. And it seems almost like a Sisyphean task, like we make a little progress and then it kind of turn your back. And the next thing you are, we're back doing some of the practices like triple queuing that we all know does not help students learn to read. And then you kind of get some progress. And the next thing you know, we're back doing something else. And, you know, it's kind of hard to really get your hand around why we have such a hard time getting these, if you will, research-based practices into action. I will say that both of us have to just do a head nod to teachers and how hard it is.
Amen.
So, you know, I just never want to talk about the gap between research and practice without recognizing the absolutely unfathomable job that teachers are asked to do every day, and the amount of challenges, problems, issues they cope with on a daily basis is just astounding. And so really what I think you and I are talking about is why schools cannot organize structures that support teachers so that using these research-based practices is feasible. Why are we not providing small enough groups, enough resources, enough professional development so that it is not a question about whether or not these practices are done? It is automatic. You cannot imagine a profession as important as teaching, you know, whether, you know, people love to compare medicine, but, you know, being a dentist or being an engineer and designing a bridge or being a engineer and fixing an airplane and not having the resources you need and having the knowledge and skills you need to do it in the best way possible. So like you, I find it very discouraging that we haven't been able to provide those resources and provide the support to teachers so they can implement research-based practices.
Absolutely. And I was just thinking back to our discussion about the Reading League earlier, you know, so much of that was teacher led and they were having to do it on the weekends and at night. And so many of the people who listen to this podcast are doing it outside of school and outside of the confines of what the school is asking them to do. And so number one, yes, teachers are heroes, and especially now because their job is harder than ever. And especially because some people, you know, do have an idea of what needs to be done. And it's frustrating when you are not being supported in doing what you know is right.
I agree with you completely. And I think that the Reading League makes all of us realize the strength in numbers and the strength of a few, both, because a few people who just said, we are fed up with this, managed to grow a league of research-based, scientifically-based research personnel across the United States. I'm so proud of them.
Yes, It's a fabulous organization. Thinking about the practice guide, there's some great recommendations, but it would be a lot for anyone to try to work on them all at once. What are some of the highest leverage practices we can use for struggling readers?
Well, I mean, I think they are somewhat dependent upon where you are in the reading process. So, you know, for very beginning readers, we really do want to be sure that they can map sounds to print. You know, as we think about the alphabetic principle, phonemic awareness, and phonics, that mapping of the sounds to print, being able to recognize how those sounds go together to form words, being able to write those words, we underestimate spelling in the early grades and the reciprocity between the orthography and the phonology. And so writing and spelling are very important, as are the phonics and phonemic awareness. So, you know, the word reading emphasis, and of course, listening comprehension and building that background knowledge and vocabulary. But those are really high impact practices at the early grades. And of course, once students can read words, we want to give them access to a lot of text, a variety of text, and a wide range of text types, because we really want to build their vocabulary and we want to build their opportunities to practice reading words. And what we've also learned is that they need to learn to generalize those rules that they learned in the early grades. So you learn a limited number of words that go with a rule. For example, if you're learning the two vowel together rule, you learn a limited number of words, but over time you get exposed to multi-syllable words, and you can only do that with a lot of opportunities to read. So, I mean, I think if I were going to just sort of say, what are some really important things right now, and it's probably because I'm not seeing enough of it, I would go back to the idea of deliberate practice, so more reading. I would go to the idea of a range of text, meaning don't forget information text and biographies, don't forget hybrid text as well as narrative text. And I would say, don't forget that we have to give students opportunities to both write words, spell words, and then make those connections to the phonics elements that we're teaching.
Brilliant advice. I know one of your big areas of research is for students with disabilities and English language learners. What do we know now about teaching these students to read and read well that we didn't know before?
Well, you know, it doesn't sound like a big finding. What I'm about to say is not going to sound like an exciting finding, and it is. So hang in there, listeners, because here's what it is. The finding is that all students learn to read in virtually the same way. So as you think about teaching a student with dyslexia, as you think about teaching a student who is an English learner, as you think about teaching a student with learning disabilities, what you know, the science of reading, applies. Now, may they need more practice? Maybe. Do they need a longer time in which they spend learning how phonemic awareness maps to print? They might. Do students who are English learners need pictures to help these words be visualized because they may not have been exposed to them? Yes. So there are ways in which we would, if you will, nuance the science of reading. However, what you know as a teacher, if you know and understand the science of reading, you are very well equipped to teach a range of students. And what you will do is then modify in ways that support that learner, just like you would for all students. Now, I don't want you out there to hear, oh, this is easy. And I don't want you to hear that, you know, we just can do the same thing for all kids. What I want you to hear is that you know a lot, and what you know will generalize to a range of learners.
That is actually really a huge finding, because for so many people, maybe I can just include myself in that. I think we keep thinking that there's like this elusive magic set of things that are going to help these students, when really we already know so much of that.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the reason I think it's important, Shelley, for teachers to know that, or educators to know that, is because we don't want them to think, oh, I can't teach that student. I'm not trained. I don't have a certificate, or I haven't taken. Well, of course, the more learning we have, the better we are at doing this. But we have, if we are equipped in the science of reading, a lot of knowledge, and we can bring it to bear.
Absolutely. So one of the papers that you co-authored is about a professional development model called STRIVE, and it's about working with students with and without disabilities. What can you tell us about the study and what did you find?
Thank you. My colleague, Elizabeth Swanson, and I did this work together. And what we were interested in is whether we could design professional development that would equip teachers to teach reading comprehension within the content area, because there are opportunities to learn how to read and to read for understanding that are outside of reading. You know, science and social studies provide great opportunities. And we wondered what would happen if we organized a set of practices that would enhance vocabulary and comprehension instruction within history and social studies and taught classroom teachers how to do that. And what we found is that it was associated with improved outcomes, both in terms of learning the content, so they learned the content better, which of course is the goal, but they also improved reading comprehension. So we found that pretty exciting.
That's awesome. In this STRIVE study, you address this huge gap in reading comprehension levels within the classroom. And I think that that's what teachers already know, but it's something that's almost like the elephant in the room where we don't say up front, this is probably more the norm than it is unusual.
Yeah.
And give people the tools that they need to address this very large variation in skill level.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that we have focused appropriately on sort of what we call the reading time for teaching these reading comprehension strategies. But as I said earlier, you know, I think we're not adequately taking advantage of other times throughout the day. I mean, the whole day is reading time. And we can teach reading comprehension really all day long.
Absolutely. So any advice to teachers who find themselves in these situations with the wide variation in the comprehension levels of the students that are sitting in front of them?
Well, you know, the range of learners in our classroom has been the challenging question for decades. We started with a one-room schoolhouse and we had a range of learners there. And we have a huge range of learners now. And we always depend on differentiated instruction. We always depend on what we think of as like one-minute lessons, small group instruction, the range of techniques that are needed. There's no secret sauce that will make it simple. It's challenging to deal with the range of learners, but we have to remember it's kind of, in a way, what makes teaching exciting, because it isn't cookie cutter. We have a lot of different learners with a lot of different needs, and it requires our innovation and creativity every day.
Absolutely. That, to me, is part of the art of teaching, is how do we reach each student? So if people want to know more about your work, where can they go to find out more?
Well, I think one of the places to go is to go to the meadowscenter.org website. And I also think that searching under Google Scholar, like I don't know how many people use Google Scholar, but it's really a good resource. And if you go there and you type in my name, my studies will just pop right up and you can read them. It's not that much fun to read them, but maybe there'll be a few findings for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that when you start reading multiple pieces of research, then you see that the findings reinforce each other from study to study. And so that is what literally we call the science of reading. That is the delightful part of reading research. So I want to thank you so much for being with me today. I've really enjoyed this and learned so much from our conversation.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me and thank you for all of your work. And I look forward to hearing from people in the future.
Join us again for the next episode of the Alabama Literacy Network.